Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Sai's glory, his divine story. Every Thursday on Morning Glory. Catch the vibe with me, Karuna Munshi, on Radio Sai's Thursday Live on Asia Stream at 9:40 a.m. Om Shri Sai Ram. Offering myself at Bhagwan's lotus feet, this is a very grateful Karuna signing in live from Prashanti Nilayam, India, the spiritual capital of the universe. And on behalf of the entire team at Radio Sai, I wish all our listeners the choicest of Bhagwan's blessings in profusion via these airwaves. Good morning and welcome to Morning Glory on Radio Sai's Asia Stream on the 20th of October 2016. The exact time in the ashram right now is 41 minutes past 9 a.m., that is Indian Standard Time. It is a super sacred Thursday morning, the day of the Guru and the historic Avatar Declaration Day. Today is also a great day for the women alumni of the Sai University and Sai schools who have converged here in large numbers for a homecoming meet. And it also happens to be a fine day in the ashram with the current temperature at 29 degrees Celsius. Clear blue skies, lots of sunshine. We are expecting a daytime high of 36 in the afternoon and overnight lows of surprisingly pleasant 21 degrees Celsius. Dear brothers and sisters, you just heard the Vedam, bhajans and a special program from the Mandir. It was webcast live in real time at radiosai.org because today the program was presented by the grateful daughters of Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba, who have studied in his schools and colleges and have returned home for a spiritual recharge at his lotus feet and for an opportunity to bond as sisters. This afternoon's program in the Mandir will also be an offering by the women alumni of the Sai schools and university. On this terrific Thursday morning, among other delights, I have lined up for you a great discussion, or rather an interview, for all of us with Dr. Sunil Menon, who is the head of the Department of General Medicine at the Sri Satya Sai General Hospital at Prashanti Nilayam. We had a chance to learn so much from Dr. Menon when he came over last week to speak to us about holistic or integrative medicine. And we know that our Lord Sai, the Supreme Doctor, advised deeper levels of healing through a holistic approach. Dear listeners, I urge you to inform your friends and family right now to tune in to Morning Glory as this interview with Dr. Sunil Menon, the head of the Department of General Medicine at Swami's General Hospital here in Prashanti Nilayam, is going to come up very shortly. And honestly, it is quite an eye-opener, and we are hoping to continue this discussion and record part two with Dr. Menon sometime tomorrow, and I hope to bring you that interview on next Thursday right here on Morning Glory. But first, I'm delighted to inform you that I have a studio guest with me to tell us more about this unique reunion by the women alumni of Sai School and University taking place here today. As you may recall, last year on 20th of October 2015 on Avatar Declaration Day, Bhagwan's grateful daughters from his school in Parthi and the Anandpur College sang melodious bhajans in unison from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. in the Divine Presence. This wonderful initiative was led by Mrs. Pushpa Ramana, the former Vice Warden and Librarian of the Anandpur campus of the Sai University. And this event last year saw women alumni come from places as far as the USA who joined us for 6 hours of uninterrupted bhajan singing with joy and gratitude. And thousands more joined us virtually through the live webcast. That last year's event was the first ever such event, and the experience was one of utter bliss, nostalgia, and deep emotion. Everyone left on a high, wanting to have more such experiences in the future. So this year, the event got further fine-tuned. And to tell us more about it, we have with us Dr. Kiran Bala Arora, who is the head of the Hindi department at the Anandpur campus of the Sai University. And Dr. Kiran Bala Arora is also the warden of the women's hostel there. Sai Ram Kiran, madam, and welcome to Morning Glory.
Sai Ram.
It's so nice to have you back in the studio. We can see so much of happiness, such intense joy visible on several hundred faces of Swami's women's students, the alumni. What exactly is going on?
As just said by you, the alumni meet actually was initiated by Bhagwan as long back as 1978-79.
That is right.
And at that time, he named it as the Kingdom of Mother Sai. But later on, he renamed it as the Messengers of Sai.
Mm-hmm.
And this went on for quite some time, for quite some years. And it was being celebrated on the eve of the Christmas evening. But then later on, Bhagwan declared that every devotee of his is his messenger. So this, the congregation of alumni sort of stopped as it was going on. And it stayed silent for quite some years. As you said, now it's initiated last year by Pushpa Madam. She was a warden for some years, and now she has resigned because of her health limitations. And now it has been taken up by some of us around here who are ready to welcome and host all the alumni all around the world who would like to come at his lotus feet on this day, the Avatar Declaration Day.
Wonderful to see so many sisters in the ashram. So where have all these ladies come from?
All around the world. Actually, I should speak. Yesterday night, I was exchanging thoughts with one of the student alumni. And she said that out of the blue, her husband just asked her that if she would want to visit India. She belongs to Abu Dhabi now. She's staying there. And the thought that the Avatar Declaration Day is being celebrated on 20th and she would like to come, it was in her heart. And Swami, as if heard her prayers, and without any pre-discussion, he just asked her to buy a ticket and come over here. And she had tears of joy in her eyes when she was relating it to me, that how Bhagwan planned it for her. And it was also very, very happy to note that some of our alumni is able to visit the divine abode after long 20 years or more.
Even. My God, it must be so nostalgic for them.
And, you know, as being experienced by all of us, there are eyes moist with joy for having been able to come at his lotus feet after long. Whatever it may be, the bond that is created when we study as student of his institutions, it just must stay on. That is what we all face eternally and eternally. And actually, when we are, you know, about to pass out of the portals of his institutions, we do not want to let go of the bond. And it is actually that feeling which made us pray to Bhagwan again and again, right back in 70s, to allow some kind of connectivity, some connection, some way of coming back to him again and again. And in answer to that, actually, this beautiful concept of alumni meet has got started. So, answering our prayers, long back Bhagwan has said, once my student, always my student. So whenever we come back, we relive those lovely moments when Bhagwan behaved like a friend, a guide, a guru, all the time available mother, listening to every plea, every prayer, every urge of ours and ready to answer it. And it is this beautiful feeling, this beautiful bond, which we relive when we come at His lotus feet here.
Truly. And I noticed there were girls from all the, from far away countries. There is a number of girls from abroad, girls from all over India, and of course all the women alumni who work in Swami's ashram or the allied institutions, whether it's the Whitefield Hospital, the Prashanthi Nilayam, two hospitals, the university, the schools, Ishwaramba School, Primary School, Central Trust. Yeah. Lot of women have dedicated their lives to serving Swami, either through the Sai organization, the Seva Samitis in their respective states or locations, or Swami's institutions run by the Central Trust.
Yes, yes. So they all, we all have converged here, and every eye is moist, you know, with just two feelings. One of intense joy, very, very deep joy, which I feel personally is not possible to be felt in human relations. And of course, there are some who feel or who miss the physical form of Bhagwan, and they intensely would like to come and have the same feeling at Prashanthi Nilayam when they were studying here and could see Him walk, you know, those lovely lotus feet on the hard rock, the floor, and they could watch Him, you know, daily exchanging, you know, lovely thoughts, words, assuaging our pains, and ready to take our letters to fill us with faith and confidence. So we relive those days, and then that fills us with so much of intense joy.
Truly. And last night when we were having the meeting to finalize all the details, I noticed there was so many different generations of students. There were students who are grandmothers and students who have just graduated only a few years ago, and there was a little child. One of the girls brought her little son who was maybe 2 years old, and he was the cutest person around because he went around touching the feet of all the elders. He was so well trained. So between, let's say, Dwarka Rani Madam, who's also an ex-student because she got her PhD from the Sai University, and this little child, there were four generations of ex-students in the same room, which was amazing. That reminds us how many years the college has been churning out graduates so silently.
Actually speaking, I have my teachers still in the college, and I have my students, and my students' students, and students' to students, and students. So actually right now in Swami's institutions, we have really 4 or 5 generations working at the same time.
That's amazing. Only Swami could have achieved such a feat. Now, what has, in terms of the program, what has transpired so far, and what is the program like for the rest of the day today?
Yeah, the viewers and the listeners have already heard the morning program. And now, at around 10:30, we meet again to have a sort of a satsang, and we practice a few group songs. And during the satsang, we'd like to exchange thoughts, experiences, and the way we relate to Bhagwan. We work through the Sevit Samitis and through the alumni congregations. And then we sort of streamline also as to how we are going to continue in the same line, for this is just the second year when it has got revived. And the structure of this alumni day, sometimes we also need to deliberate as on the date. Of course, we feel blessed because it is the 20th October, the day in 1940 when Bhagwan declared that He was the avatar of the age. But sometimes, practically speaking, the alumni from far off places are not able to make it because they are tied up with their family and social commitments. So we also are deliberating on how to make it and to when to decide to have it again, so that more and more of us can come up and fill the hearts with joy. And so we'll also be deliberating on those points.
And if I may take the liberty of adding, we'll also have the pleasure of having our lunch together.
Yes, we are going to have that also, like how we had
dinner together. Like meet and greet dinner yesterday. Yeah. So we enjoyed the South Indian Canteen Prasadam, and today the North Indian Canteen Prasadam. All the sisters together bonding as one family.
Yes, yes, yes. We're looking forward for all the special items that we are going to have together.
It just brings you back to those days when Swami was particular. How many desserts, how many curries, how many items are there? Food items, is that feeling of being directly under His care.
His love, His care. Because I recollect when He used to come and have His lunch or dinner with us when He used to visit the campus, He would go investigating every plate if there was any item missing and immediately warn the warden or call somebody out to fill it with that particular item. And I also remember one beautiful small incident which our one of the very senior alumna, a very senior teacher had with Bhagwan. She was from a Brahmin family, an Orthodox family, and she would not consume either the preparations made or added with garlic or onion.
I see.
So she had not opted for a few items which she suspected would have these ingredients. And then when Swami came on the lines where we were sitting with our plates, the plates also offered, gifted by Bhagwan, and then He observed there are a few items missing in her plate. And she was Miss Rajalakshmi, Political Science Department. She's still working with us. She joined.
She has taught me political science.
Yeah. So when He watched that there were some items missing, He asked her why she hasn't taken those items, and she said, "No, Swami, these items may contain onion and garlic, which I don't consume, and so I have not taken." And Swami was quick to answer. He snapped back and said, "No, take. It is all prasad. The cooks who serve, the cooks who prepare the food items, have been the rishis in their last births, and now they are cooking food for me and you. Whatever comes from this kitchen is Swami's prasad."
Aww.
And He actually made her take those items and consume them in front of Him.
Fantastic. And we are so lucky we ate that prasadam for so many years.
Yes,
growing
day
up.
After day. Yeah. And many times over in a day.
I know. And you know, I'm doing this next interview which I'm going to play, where Dr. Sunil Menon speaks of the effect of food on our body, on our mind, on our thought process and everything.
Yes.
So imagine having the divine blessing of eating His prasadam. Now, madam, you just came to the studio from the mandir where the program was going on. So please tell our listeners, what's the general mood like amongst the group right now?
My God, it is difficult to define. Such enthusiasm, such joy, and such happiness. I think the words would fail to describe it. Everybody is just full of joy, they feel their blessings. I don't think so any other place could give them this joy. And particularly because they're meeting their own, you know, batchmates, classmates,
teachers,
seniors, juniors, teachers, all at one in one day and together. And even how are you if you ask the question to anybody? Oh, I'm just happy to be here. It looks as if they've forgotten everything else in the world, in their lives. Right now, they are enjoying this moment intensely.
Yes, they are really in the moment. You can feel it. And yesterday, as the meeting was going on, I took the liberty of taking some pictures and posting them on WhatsApp in real time and saying, "Girls, right now we are doing this," because so many sisters are engaged with us on WhatsApp.
Mm-hmm.
And girls were writing back, "Can you just record? We saw Pushpa Madam. She looks exactly how she looked 20 years ago when I was a student. Can you please record her voice and put a video? We are missing all of you so much. We are missing our teachers. We can see them after so many years." So that bond, that connection.
And I can understand the alumni who's not been able to join us now. They're really feeling, you know, sort of jealous that they were missing something very, very
But they're so happy
beautiful.
For the rest of us,
yes,
because they're all
happy.
Wishing us good
and
luck.
And in their hearts they're with us here.
Of course.
Yeah.
And to Radio Sai, madam, if I may add with all humility.
Sure,
because they're going to watch the program on the webcast live this afternoon. And in the morning they heard it live and they're listening to you right now. So that is fantastic. Thank you so much. Any parting thoughts, Kiran madam?
I would just like to convey from on behalf of all the teachers that have been associated with all the alumni around the world that I pass on my love to them on behalf of Bhagwan and on behalf of all the teachers, a tight hug and a beautiful little kiss on the cheeks. Let them all feel happy and feel connected to us and feel the same joy that we are feeling now. We pass it on to them. Let them also enjoy it.
Oh, that's very sweet. Thank you. And dear sisters, that's for you. The blessings from Bhagwan. Thank you, Kiran Madam, for bringing our listeners up to speed regarding this alumni meet for the women students of Swami's schools and colleges. And we really appreciate your participation in this live studio discussion.
Sairam.
Sairam, Madam. Dear listeners, that was Dr. Kiran Bala Arora, of the Anandpur campus of the Sai University. She is the head of the Hindi department there, as also the warden of the women's hostel. And she was telling us about the reason and the history behind this sea of blue saris that we see moving in large numbers in the ashram today. Is Swami the ocean? We, his daughters, are the tiny waves that emerge from him and then merge back into him. Swami is our source, our love, our goal, our all. And to celebrate this close bond with our divine founding chancellor, we, the women alumni of this educational his educational institutions, have gathered here at his lotus feet to offer our respects, gratitude and love to our beloved Bhagwan. On that very joyful and grateful note, I'm delighted to bring you today's feature presentation on Morning Glory. This is an in-depth, informative conversation with Dr. Sunil Menon, the head of the department of the Sri Sathya Sai General Hospital. He's the head of the Department of General Medicine at the Sri Sathya Sai General Hospital here in Prashanthi Nilayam. And dear sisters and brothers, I suggest you take notes as you listen to Dr. Menon discuss integrative healthcare. And while you're listening to him, if you have a question for the doc, email it to me at karuna@radiosai.org. K as in kite, A R for Robert, U N for Nancy, A. KARUNA@radiosai.org. What I will do is I will try to include your queries into my interview that we are recording with Dr. Menon tomorrow. And you can hopefully find your answers from Dr. Menon on Morning Glory next Thursday. But for now, have your pad and pencil ready and enjoy this extremely enlightening and delightful interview that we recorded with Dr. Sunil Menon last Friday on October the 14th, 2016. And here it is for your listening pleasure. Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to a special conversation. The topic of discussion today is integrative medicine or holistic health, and my guest is especially qualified to enlighten us on this topic. His name is Dr. Sunil Menon, MD, and Dr. Sunil Menon is the head of the Department of General Medicine at the Sri Sathya Sai General Hospital in Prashanthi Nilayam. By way of his academic background, I am pleased to inform you that Dr. Menon completed his MD in respiratory medicine from the Mumbai University. He went on to specialize in allergy and environmental medicine with AAEM in the United States under Dr. Bill Ray, a pioneer on the subject. He continued his further training in nutritional medicine with various experts in the field while in the United Kingdom. Presently, he works as the head of the department in Swami's General Hospital right here in Prashanthi Nilayam. And currently, he continues to be associated with doctors in the United States who practice a new field called functional medicine, which takes a holistic approach to disease management. He is very interested in introducing some of his principles to the patients who attend General Hospital. And these principles include yoga. So, keeping Swami's teachings in mind, we thought it was an ideal time for us to bring our listeners up to speed on this very concept of functional medicine, which takes this holistic approach to disease management. On that very happy note, I am glad to welcome Dr. Sunil Menon to Radio Sai. Sairam, sir.
Sairam, thank you very much. It's a privilege to be here and share some of my thoughts on the subject and whatever little bit I know. Thank you.
And we are truly honored to have you. We have so much to learn from you. Now, we noticed, Dr. Menon, that there is a need to shift the healthcare paradigm, and this is becoming public discourse, not only in India, but also in the United States, in the United Kingdom, parts of Europe. What can you tell us about it?
Well, science always has needed something new to happen if things don't work. So for a long time, doctors have been realizing Western medicine, as we call it, conventional medicine, as we call it, has been very successful in acute care. And the technology has boomed, and the pharmaceutical companies have their share in it. And health has become an industry to save patients. And it has been quite successful. If you are caught in the right time, you are close to a good hospital, and you have the facilities, including the fact whether you can afford all that. Yeah. Acute care medicine is actually doing very well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trained in conventional medicine, and you know, I'm trained in to give acute care. And in the general hospital, you know, most of the patients who do come in an acute state of need or help, we do help them. The problem is, statistics show that chronic disease is increasing. And our healthcare approach is not really, really an answer to chronic disease. What they call as non-communicable diseases is on the increase. For example, diabetes, which was about 15th on the list in India, has now jumped up to number 6 position.
Hmm.
And they say by 2050, it'll be number 2 or number 3.
Oh, alarming.
The other thing they noticed was that 80% of chronic diseases are diet and lifestyle mediated.
Tough one.
And if it is diet and lifestyle, they should be preventable.
Yes.
And all over the world, they are worried.
What percentage did you say?
80%.
So it's not your DNA you can blame?
Nope. Nope. Unfortunately, only 25% of the conditions can be blamed on the DNA. The rest is environment and diet. That's the shocking thing they realize now. You're not born or prone to diabetes. You may have the gene somewhere in your body hanging about, but you become diabetic because of a diet and your lifestyle.
And that's very unfortunate what you said about diabetes in India.
Yeah.
So we are leading such poor lifestyle, making poor lifestyle choices and our diet choices that we are going up the list.
True.
So what exactly is the difference between acute and chronic illness?
Well, basically, I'll talk about the approach. You know,
yes.
In an acute illness, why modern medicine works is because we are taught to deal with a patient's complaint. We are taught to investigate the patient. We are taught to do some tests. And then we reach a conclusion of what to give. And in most of the conditions that come to us in an acute state, there are protocols to deal with it. Unfortunately, if you use the same methodology in a chronic illness, say for example, a diabetic, there are multifactorial things that's happening in the patient. All diabetics are not the same. Unfortunately, again, Western medicine treats everybody the same. And they got the same protocol. And that doesn't work because individual prescription is now being demanded by the condition of the patient. And we find where did the patient come from, what lifestyle did the patient lead, and what led to the diabetes may have different factors which need to be addressed. For example, in a particular case, it may be just diet. In another case, it may be genes. In a third case, it may be the general lifestyle. And the fourth case, it may be stress. If you know what is really precipitating the diabetes, the same formula doesn't work. So a patient should be assessed in such a way that we take all these factors into account. The problem is today's doctors don't have the time for that. It takes quite a bit of investment by the doctor to do this, and it takes a lot of investment by the patient to participate in his or her health. Modern science and modern technology and the way we are brought up, we want the doctor to fix the problem. Most of my patients who come to my room and sit in front of me, they've got a lot of issues, but they don't want to discuss that. They come with a problem and they say, "Doctor, you fix it for me." They don't even want to participate in the fixing. They feel the injection or the drug or the tablet will do the job. They go back to their diet and lifestyle. Nothing changes. And we find that pharmaceutical companies are inventing new medicines every year. But the progress of disease all over the world has continued.
That seems so incoherent.
True. There is a subject which come up in the functional medicine group. They call it the 21st century medicine. And they say that their approach is so radically different. They say if a chair has got four legs, one leg is the diet, the second leg is the lifestyle, the third leg is the nutrients and whether they exercise or not. And surprisingly, the fourth leg is yoga, meditation, and spirituality.
Really?
And that is what pulled me to into this group of people who seemed to reflect what Swami was saying.
Exactly. Swami is the pioneer of this stream of medicine and all medicines, of course.
True. And maybe it's the right time for human beings to wake up and realize the Annamaya Kosha is what the doctors are dealing with till now.
Which is the outermost sheath of the human personality.
And we have forgotten about the Manomaya Kosha and the Pranamaya Kosha, totally. These people are now realized that you cannot just treat the Annamaya Kosha with drugs. You need to bring the other koshas into the picture.
So what can you tell us, or how can you educate us to understand the need to treat ourselves as a conglomerate of all these koshas or the various layers or sheets that make the human personality?
Well, to start with the first kosha, the Annamaya Kosha, it's made of Anna, food. That's where the diet comes in.
Okay.
And invariably the exercise is part of it. And diet just doesn't consist of food. When we talk about diet, we are talking about nutrients. And we must ask ourselves a question that what has changed? Everybody eats food. Why should some people fall sick and not get the nutrients? For that, historically speaking, we must look at what was the human being's diet thousands of years ago. They lived very close to nature. And there is a strong connection between what you eat, and what you breathe, and where you live, to how your genes and how your body performs. For example, Eskimos, they eat a lot of blubber and fish oil and fish. They hardly eat vegetables and grains. If you look at the Eskimo diet, you know, it can't be followed by any other culture. But their genes have adjusted to the environment. They hand over that to their children. If you take the same Eskimo and modernize him and give him an American diet, within 10 years, they all get diabetes and hypertension.
But they don't have diabetes up in the North Pole.
No. They don't even have heart attacks.
So the body has just adapted.
Adapted. And what has happened today is that we have forgotten that our genes play a part. We inherit our lifestyle and diet habits, which is why perhaps, historically speaking, we had caste systems, because each caste had its own environment, and own lifestyle, and own diet habits.
And vocation.
And vocation. Mm. And all of them matched with what they did and what
yes.
they ate. They had a separate set of vibrations. Today what has happened is, two things have happened. One is that we don't live our lives close to nature. For example, our hormones are related to sunlight. So when you wake up, your hormones kick start, and then throughout the day it plays its part. By 7 o'clock it starts shutting down.
Mm-hmm.
If you live in artificial light, this doesn't happen. And the sleep hormone called melatonin requires darkness.
Yes.
But if you watch TV or if you're sitting in front of a computer, you are messing with the melatonin. Your body gets confused. You say the light is still coming in, so I should be awake. So what it does is it produces cortisol to keep you awake. And cortisol, unfortunately, suppresses further melatonin. So your whole hormonal cycle is disturbed. You don't get good sleep. When you wake up next morning, to kickstart, you take a coffee with a lot of sugar.
Yes.
And invariably that gives you initial energy. But it is messing with the natural cycle. It can go on when you're young, but after the age of 45, this starts breaking down.
But even amongst youngsters in the IT industry who work on American time zones in India in call centers, this is a huge problem because they are exposed to artificial light all night and they have a very disrupted sleep cycle.
True. So now the research is showing that some people adapt. The person who comes to the doctor is the one who's not adapted. So we are generally dealing with people who are not adapted.
Mm-hmm.
And the numbers are increasing. That is the danger. You see, if the numbers remained at, say, what, 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000, we wouldn't worry so much.
Mm-hmm.
But the numbers are increasing so much that now we are realizing the human body is adapted since millions of years. For a gene to change, it takes 1 million years.
Wow, so many generations.
Exactly. So maybe in the next 1 million years, you know, we may have human beings who are different than us. At the present moment, we are not winning the battle at all. And the costs are going up. It's not affordable for a person to really, really look after health. Health has become expensive. It has become an industry. when actually it shouldn't. You know, it should be preventive, and it should be lifestyle choices and diet. So what these functional medicine, integrative medicine, and holistic medicine people have found out, that if you actually take that individual and give them advice to change their lifestyle, to change their diet, and become as organic as possible, and the problem now is the processing of foods. The micronutrients are not available. And the soil has been so enriched with fertilizers and artificial means and pesticides that the chemistry has changed. So what you see as food on the table is not the real great-grandmother's food on the table. And the wheat and the grains have also been modified. GMO foods have come.
Mm.
And they found that the nutritional value really doesn't exist. So cleverly what the companies do is they add some rubbish and say that this is fortified.
Mm.
But it's not natural.
I see.
And the human body is so clever that it can make the difference. That, oh, this is not coming. For example, if you take magnesium, as an example, as a mineral that's missing in 80% of our diet now, we fortify with magnesium oxide, which is the cheapest compound available.
In a multivitamin tablet.
Multivitamin tablet.
Yes.
That's the worst chemical that the body can take, because magnesium oxide is not absorbed.
I see.
The body doesn't like it, in other words. It's not biological. So what the body does is throw it out.
Uh-huh.
So we giving supplements in this chemical fashion has not really matched our lifestyle.
What is a natural source of magnesium?
Well, the fact is they don't have a natural source from fruits and vegetables. But if you want some, really want to get lots of it, then you have to eat nuts and seeds. Out of which the cheapest available in Parthi is pumpkin seeds, which are melon seeds, which they throw away. All they have to do is just, you know, dry it, roast it and eat it.
Peanuts also?
Peanuts, yes, certain amount, but if you want the kind of high quality magnesium which our body needs as a replacement, it's found in green leafy vegetables a lot, but then you have to eat at least 4 servings of it, which many people don't. The vegetables are just floating about, so the quantity matters, which is the problem. Really, the whole family sharing, a dish, the amount of vegetable going to as a serving to a person is very much reduced. And the other big issue now is with oil. Oil has come up as one of the biggest issues that
we
are
refining. We are bombarded with advertisements that confuse us which is the right oil. What is your take on it, doctor?
Well, the research now shows that fat has been mentioned to be one of the biggest toxins. And we said that saturated fat should never be eaten. And we should all go into polyunsaturated fat and all that rubbish till now. And we believed it. And the real culprit is sugar. So sugar is the one that is the killer today. Sugar in the sense that doesn't include sugar by itself. It includes all our refined flour
and
polished rice. That breaks down to sugar. It's equivalent to sugar.
I see.
So our body doesn't differentiate. So if you eat polished rice, a cupful of polished rice is equivalent to, 6 spoons of sugar.
Oh dear.
So, in the past, that wasn't the case. We used food that wasn't refined at all. And the oil we used was cold-pressed. And it was either cold-pressed or extracted, by just squeezing it between, a grinder in the local village.
Yes.
And it was brought home, and you cook with it, and you don't use it for, a month or 2 months. We take the amount we need, and then we crush it again. And that is biologically alive. And it's got all the ingredients. The other problem is refined oil is omega-6. And it's a highly inflammatory oil. And omega-6 is not very good. It's good for the body for certain jobs. What we need is omega-3. Omega-3 is unfortunately not very well absorbed unless in vegetarian diets. It's mainly found in fish oil.
Fish oil, yeah.
And we had to eat a lot of flaxseed to get a lot of omega-3.
Yes.
When you refine oil, all the omega-3 is disappeared.
Oh. Yeah.
And mustard oil is another choice, which has got quite a bit of omega-3. Coconut oil has got some.
What about ghee? Because Ayurveda says organic ghee is very good.
Exactly. So now they are saying that provided the cow is eating grass,
yes,
and it's your own cow and you're lovingly, looking after it.
Hmm.
If you mix milk from 20 cows and then produce ghee out of it, that's a problem. So the source is the issue now, and it's become a problem all over the world. When you say organic, how organic is it? Can we go back to that level of manufacturing? No easy answer. But if you want to clear your health issues, you have no choice. You have to really, really get out of the system allow the body to repair itself, then maybe you'll tolerate a little bit of, you know, the processed food. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of patients that come to us, where the damage is so severe that they feel a drug can rectify it. Unfortunately, in chronic illness, it doesn't do the job.
When you say processed food, what exactly do you mean? I can't think of too many things that I buy off the shelf which has not gone through some process.
Yeah. The ideal thing would be, you know, the apple should come straight from a tree without pesticides on it. If the banana is being artificially ripened while it is being transported from Africa or wherever, the process is interfered with. It's the processing. If you pasteurize milk, and then you mix milk and put it in a plastic container and sell it after 2 weeks, that is processed food. But if you actually take milk from a cow next to you, in the olden days, the cow used to be brought and the milking was done in front of you. So it is straight from there to the boiling and you drink it. And that's the end of the story. So processing is now part of our lifestyle. But by heavy processing, I mean chemicals. For example, refined oil comes to you without odor, golden colored, you know, looking so nice, with a high boiling point, is processed through a lot of chemical processes, which destroys the original organic oil.
And, you know, it took me so many years to realize that there is no grain called canola. When I was buying canola oil, it is CAN comes from Canada and Ola is oil and it's just a genetically modified grain.
True. The tragedy is they don't sort of tell us about all these things. If you look at the fact that where is sugar present? It's present everywhere. Whether you use a ketchup or a sauce or buy bread.
Yes.
So sugar is one of the hidden culprits. And now the research shows that sugar is the one that causes what is known as insulin resistance. And we have replaced carbohydrate in our diet. So if you compare diet 10,000 years ago, the amount of grains they used wasn't that much. And then when it became very cheap and available to everybody and it became a good source of, you know, calories, people started replacing normal food with a lot of grain. Originally, grain was there as an extra bit on the plate. But today, it's a lot of grain and a little bit of chutney and
everything else around it.
Around it.
They're fixins.
And we have become a carbohydrate-based population.
True.
And our human body has got 20 feet of intestine to digest meals. And why is there such a long intestine there? It shows that it's expected food to be really broken down gradually. And we are supposed to eat what is known as complex carbohydrates, carbohydrates in its original form. Today, because of modification, the grain has got less of the fiber and more of the carbs, which is good because you get you know, more energy out of it. Unfortunately, in a sugar format.
Mm-hmm. Now, many of our listeners, for example, are either vegetarian or are leaning towards vegetarianism, and there is always this confusion regarding the protein requirement for a healthy body. What is your advice to vegetarians when it comes to seeking out good sources of protein, and how much?
I think that's an excellent question because we don't have an easy answer to that. Poverty and malnutrition go together. If you're undernourished, you know, it goes together. So the replacement of good protein from varied sources is the answer. So if you eat a lot of different lentils and mix it with a lot of legumes and then eat a lot of nuts and seeds, then a vegetarian is fine. But if you look at the expense of feeding a whole family like that, is the problem. There is no really, really easy answer to compensate for the fact that a vegetarian needs a varied format of protein intake, because the essential amino acids are not present in every grain or seed or lentil or legume.
Ragi is supposed to be
so
rich.
Yes. So one thing is the unfortunate thing in vegetarian food, one particular source cannot cover for all the sources. So you need what is known as a balanced mix of different protein sources. So if you take urad dal along with moong dal, along with groundnuts and other legumes like broad beans or narrow beans, then there is a mix along with ragi. That's good.
And along with seeds and nuts.
Now, in the past, eating seeds and nuts was rather standard in every family. All grandmothers had a little tin of various seeds and nuts, including my grandfather. She used to have different formats. I find even jackfruit seeds were roasted and eaten in Kerala. And it's not just the jackfruit itself is eaten. Almonds were eaten, cashew nuts were eaten. It was all available, and it was part of our culture to eat different seeds. Unfortunately, what has happened is we have become partly westernized. And then we have gone into what is known as convenience foods. So, and these convenience foods are not really nutrient dense, as you call it. You know?
They're just calorie dense.
Calorie dense. But that's become, you know, a habit of people to, you know, have a chai and then go for the wrong food. Yeah. Nobody eats chai and peanuts or chai and seeds or chai and nuts.
Yeah, you want samosa or a bhaji or something fried.
Exactly.
Deep fried. Twice, if preferably.
So invariably the nutrient content is zero and the calorie is very high. And nutrition is a very poorly taught subject in schools. And most of the parents who come to me, they have a little idea of, you know, you're feeding the wrong things to a growing child. They also believe that milk compensates for a lot of nutrition.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, actually, you know, human beings are the only animals on the planet drinking some other animal's milk. We have adapted, but unfortunately about 60% of human beings are milk intolerant. Only the people in France, Scandinavia, and certain few countries have milk tolerant. India in some parts. But generally we are milk intolerant.
Is it a genetic issue?
It is, most probably.
I think people are not that conscious about lactose intolerance in India.
True. We don't diagnose it because the symptoms are different in different individuals. And the other thing is the type of milk has changed. The original milk, it's called A2 milk, comes from the original cow, which ate grass. All over the world now we got the hybrid milk, because the hybrid cows, it's called A1 milk. And they found A1 milk is highly allergic and very intolerant. And many patients, when they switch to, you know, a desi cow, as they call it, they tolerate the milk. They digest it better.
Wow.
So there are a lot of factors that are involved.
It's like Devonshire cream, which is supposed to be the best, but those cows eat specific kind of grass only.
Exactly.
It reflects in the taste of the milk and its purity.
The fact is omega-3 is available from the grass. Modern cows, the way they make milk is they feed them grain.
Yes.
And
sometimes even
and
worse
cows don't
things.
Eat grain. Cows
yeah,
don't eat
it's
grass.
Not their natural food.
Natural food. And invariably, you know, they fatten them up quite a bit. That's mainly for the meat industry. But the milk is spoiled. So milk, and they get a lot of antibiotics and,
yes,
they
and hormones.
They get a lot of hormones. And invariably, they are messing with, that's what I call processing. Processing doesn't just end in a box. Processing starts with the animal itself. And it's a subject which people are aware of. And they are going organic, but the industry is in charge. So invariably they rule the roost, they control what people eat.
And they inundate us with messages through advertising and completely brainwash us.
True. The other problem really is that people tend to believe what somebody else says, and when they come to nutritional approach, they're quite surprised that nobody talks in that language. So invariably they are suspicious that, oh, nobody told us about this till now. Why are you bringing this subject all of a sudden? But common sense actually works. I'll tell you a simple story I read the other day. I think it came in the Deccan Chronicle. And I was surprised to read that article. There is this tribe somewhere in Assam living very close to the forest. They were leading a very traditional life. Nothing processed. Everything they made was made right there. Most of the forest produce actually fed them. Unfortunate thing was they were not modern. They were not educated. So the government went and said, you don't have much cash with you. You're living like tribals. You're not coming into the modern world. So they wanted to modernize them. So in order to help them, they said, let's grow some cash crops, as they call it. And they built, they deforested the place, and they forested it with cash-growing crops like eucalyptus and, you know, teak and all sorts of things. To end the story, basically the forest died. So these guys didn't have anything to eat. So the government said, don't worry, we'll supply you with sugar and
rice and more sugar.
More sugar,
yes.
and flour and rice at cheap rates, and our refined oil. Now, the elders didn't like it very much, but they had no choice. After 10 years, they noticed that their children were falling ill. And then a dietary team went to check, I think a medical team went to check the standard of health of these people and found it had gone down. There was malnourishment, there was undernourishment, there was all sorts of health problems which was never existed.
So much for the civilized approach to living.
In 10 years.
Yes.
Now these people then protested. Actually the ladies, the elderly ladies, they said, we want all of us to go back to our original diet, give back our forest. So they abandoned that site and went to a separate forest area and let the original site grow back. And when they shifted their area of living and their diet and lifestyle, everything improved by itself.
My God, amazing.
And this is...
And within a span of what, 2 decades?
2 decades.
My God.
And that whole article came up and written by a nutritionist. And I was surprised to read it in Deccan Chronicle, which shows that it's not that we don't know the subject. We know that if human beings shift to what we call as modern diet, and if it doesn't have the nutrients in it, the body will react. You put the body back into its original habitat, in its original environment, and the original diet. Nature takes care of itself. God has made the body so beautifully. It's got a self-healing process. You have to be intelligent enough to help that self-healing process. And you go into either cure or reversal or remission without drugs.
Now, this you were talking about the different koshas or the layers or sheets that make up a person. This is at a physical level. What comes next?
Well, now the latest research shows what is really killing a large percentage of modern individuals is stress. And we think stress as something bionic or something very serious or something which comes with a jolt from the sky.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all. The state of happiness of your mind, the way you live life, the way your achievements and, you know, your attitudes are, is contributing to stress. So what is happening today is a lot of unrealistic expectations. And when these unrealistic expectations hit you, very slowly, we think that there is no stress. The person pretends to jog through life with a smiling face. They also sort of tend to feel they are actually winning the whole equation. But the body is very clever. However you put that smiley face for society's sake, internally, the mind knows. And what it produces is a hormone called cortisol. Now, cortisol has been created by nature for acute stress. And that is the fight or flight phenomenon.
Hmm.
So when there's an acute problem, you know, 10,000 years ago, problems were either acute, which they had to deal with, and you dealt with it.
Like a tiger attacking me in a forest.
So even if there is a crisis, you know, usually you find that the crisis is solved with a philosophical look at it. It is not that it should be solved. They look at it in a philosophical manner. Today, you know, it's an instant gratification society. They want it to be done. If the bus is a little late, they get angry. So, you know, if you're stuck in a traffic jam, you lose your mind. So we are in a society where stress reaction seems to be normal.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't even bother if that reaction is seen.
Unacceptable. To throw a fit, to use foul language, or to fling your arms and get upset.
And invariably that raises your cortisol.
I see.
And that is a very bad hormone to increase.
And I'm sure it's a slew of other chain reactions that happen. Your blood pressure goes up, you're hyperventilating.
Your blood sugar goes up. And the biggest unfortunate thing is we've got two brains. One is the primitive brain, the reptilian brain, which is required for our emotional reaction and all our emotions. And then we got the cortex, the frontal cortex, which is the brain where the logic and the analysis comes in. Most of the time our reptilian brain is switched on, and our reaction is at that level. If we have not practiced, what we need is allow our superior brain to take over. And how to switch is the question. Because we are in stress from morning till evening, and we are decision making, and we need quick decisions. So what happens is the instant reaction comes in. So we don't reflect.
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't have time to reflect, is one of the things they say all the time. And cortisol, you know, kickstarts the reptilian brain. And invariably, you know, once it does that, you lose control. And whatever we say, whatever comes out of our mouth, is controlled by the reptilian brain. It's a reactive brain.
And then we can regret over it for the rest of our lives, but the words have escaped.
And how do we train the superior brain, the superior cortex? Well, by meditation. So what they found is that if you want your manomaya kosha to really, really work, and there is a machine that can measure what is known as, it's called a heart rate variable measurement. And the machine can measure that. If your heart rate variable has got a very smooth pattern, because the heart rate keeps varying, and the machine, it's not beat to beat, it's not the same. So this machine can monitor it. If it comes in a very smooth fashion, that means invariably your cortisol level is normal and you're generally calm and you know, you're okay. If it is all over the place, it means, although you may not be showing it externally, but your heart knows, it shows. So you meditate. And they found that, and this is done in the UK, and if you meditate, your heart rate changes. Immediately it calms down.
So what do you mean by meditate? Is it silent sitting, guided meditation, vipassana?
It is basically something that suits you. And you know, there are techniques where you just sit in your office and control your breathing, and just watch your breath. And you do it at intervals of, you know, 5 to 10 and stop it. And then after an hour or so, do another 5 to 10. That's good enough to correct your heart rate.
It's like a reset button.
So it's a reset button. So you just stop everything and close your eyes and just watch your breath. Now that is the, I think, the quickest way I've read about with effects, and which anybody can do. But if you talk about, you know, the prolonged format of meditation, which certainly has got more spiritual connotations to it, and a large percentage of people perhaps wouldn't want to go into that area when they're leading a normal life. If they want to do that, that's fine. If they got time to do it, that's
but
fine.
But amongst in the 9-point code of conduct, Swami said we should do Jyoti meditation every day.
Absolutely. So,
if we follow it, we won't have much of this issue of overreacting and falling into the stress trap.
Absolutely. You see, it's health hygiene.
Well
so,
said.
So we have to look at the mind hygiene also.
Yes.
So whether you watch television and you know have to be in a conference or whether you have to be in a meeting, you're absorbing all negative energy anyway. Without you knowing, your hormones are going all over the place. How do we switch it off? And you have to have a health hygiene of doing that, and the manomaya kosha is taken care of.
So going further or deeper into this, past the manomaya kosha, what can you teach us?
Well, what they have found in research is, it is not just enough looking after your physical and looking after your mental. You must have a spiritual background. Now, they use the word spiritual, unlike using the word religious.
Religion, yeah.
Because that causes a lot of conflict in your mind.
I wonder why, though. What's the big deal? But yeah, in an age of political correctness, they prefer to use the spiritual.
And then what they found was, what is the biggest problem today that is affecting the Western world, which is perhaps coming here? Isolation and loneliness. So they didn't know what that was all about. They're giving all the physical comforts. They're giving an old people's home all the coins required by an old person. They're putting the old person in front of a television. Didn't work. And the states of dementia and Alzheimer's, most of these patients got worse in such a situation. So nutritionally they were all right. And as far as comforts were there, they were all right. Medically they were looked after by doctors. Loneliness and isolation causes lack of love. And what they discovered was, by just hugging these people, by just putting them into what is known as hugging groups, where strangers went them and sat with them, just held their hands for 10 minutes, need not be their relatives at all. Somebody else. It was done silently. It was not done by talk, because talk wasn't required. Just the transference of love perked these people up. So they found that if you're not really spiritual, in the kind of, you know, inverted commas kind of bracket, what was the essence of life was love. And they said, you don't have to be religious, you don't have to be spiritual, but love we can always give. And this was very surprising for them, because in the Western culture, they didn't know the effect of it. Now, in the Indian context, the joint family always had this bonding. There was always a spinster aunt or a widowed aunt or a grandmother who we used to run to. And I know my younger days where there was always this particular person who had a lot of time for us. So if all the other elders are busy, or they will send us to this person, they say, oh, you go to this person. And that person will be calmly sitting down, smiling away, and be with us. What was being transferred was nothing intellectual, no advice.
Mm-hmm.
It was just the transfer of, I'm there for you.
Mm-hmm.
And that factor is what we basically call spirituality. We are now put a lot of other definitions to it. But the easiest definition, which I think matches with Swami's words all along, start the day with love, spend the day with love, and end the day with love. What is that all about?
And embodiments of love.
Exactly. And he tells doctors too, he said that don't spend, you know, time writing prescriptions. Spend time talking to the patient. He said, I would prefer you talk 20 minutes to the patient and write the prescription in a minute or so, instead of the other way around. So basically, this is the fourth leg of the stool, which I talked about, or the chair. You know, you do the nutrition, you do the diet, you do the lifestyle, you do the exercise, yoga, you do the meditation. If you miss the love factor, it doesn't work. And this is a surprising thing integrative medicine found. Because they never thought holistically, the love factor was so important that if you are positive, and the love can come in many forms. And we have found that among patients. Patients who are very innocent and positive, they recover faster. We find our village patient who comes from, you know, the distant villages from Parthi. They come to our hospital. They have absolute faith in Swami. They have absolute faith in the doctor. They have absolute faith in everything.
Thank God. They're not cynical.
Nope.
As the city educated, who have read up on Wikipedia and come.
Exactly. And sometimes we don't know how they recover, you know, and
I think the buy-in is complete.
Exactly. And invariably, it's not our effort. We just don't know that why this patient is waking up and then eating idlis next morning. Who is curing? And if you say that the doctor is curing, I think that is very, very small way of looking at it. In the big picture, what is curing is this patient is full of positivity. And the patient's faith is 100%. There's no doubt in the patient's mind, which we can't transfer with words, we can't transfer with an injection, we can't transfer with a tablet. It is an attitudinal thing, and which should start right from the gate, you see. The moment they enter, the transference of love should start right from the gate. It should transfer to the nurse, it should transfer to the doctor, and to the treatment. And integrative medicine has jumped onto it and realized that if you have all the factors and no love, which is what is happening in modern corporate hospitals, where you get an air-conditioned room, where the consultant comes in, talks to you for a couple of seconds, you get a big bill at the end of the day, and they feel you should be cured.
And you're right, absolutely. I can completely relate to what you're saying. Now, integrative medicine seems like the answer to the problems of healthcare of our times. How is it being received, this outlook, this vision being received by conventional medical schools? Because I noticed some in the US, like Duke and a few others, they were spending quite a bit of their budget and their time on integrative medicine, whereas others are not up to speed.
The sad thing is, it is a health industry.
Yes. Everything is an industry at the end of the day.
And it's controlled by the pharmaceutical companies.
Who want their pills to sell.
And invariably, it's like processed food. Coca-Cola wants everybody to drink Coca-Cola. And you know that, you know, it's such a strong acid that you can wash your toilet bowl with it. So invariably, they found that for any scientific change to occur, attitudinal change to occur, it takes a lot of time. Human beings don't switch very quickly. And in the medical field, it takes more time than necessary. The famous story is the Samwell story of Germany, where he was a gynecologist, obstetrician, in the early 1910. And in those days, the doctors never washed their hands. They used to go from patient to patient, delivering baby to baby, without washing their hands. And they used to just wipe it on their you know, apron. It was a big privilege for them not to wash hands. And they found the mothers were getting infected with something known as puerperal fever. And he introduced a simple thing, and he said, in those days they didn't have these kind of antiseptics. So he used a very, very strong liquid of bleach. And he told all his doctors, his junior doctors and himself, he said, we'll all wash our hands before going to the next patient. And the infection rate fell. It was practically as high as 40 per 100. It fell to 2 per 100. But it took 75 years for that idea to catch on.
To become protocol.
Yeah, protocol. So, people still didn't wash.
But with IT revolution, you know, grandmothers using WhatsApp, hasn't the pace of adapting quickened, in your opinion? That
yeah. Adapting in the sense that we have superficially picked up more tools to decrease, you know, the labor of work. But in the process, we have lost a lot of our brain tissue because the brain cannot continue its sharpness unless you use it. They found that if after the age of 65, you take up a new profession and a new study, you don't get Alzheimer's.
That's right. I've been reading that. Do you concur with that?
Oh, absolutely. It's because whatever we talk about aging is because of a misuse and disuse of things. And invariably, all these tools is not adapting. We are learning shortcuts to make our body not work. And nature doesn't work that way because our human biology took a million years to develop. Within a span of 100 years, we are technologically, you know, gone into space and gone all these magic things. In the process, we have ignored the fact that our human being itself is not meant to live like this. We are not meant to live with 24-hour light and 24-hour telephones
and stimulations
and computers and TV. We may adapt in another million years, who knows. But the present generation is breaking apart and the idea of living life like that is an artificial idea the Western world has brought in. They seem to presume that nature is not important. They have isolated man from nature entirely. They also found that, you know, night shift workers get more cancers. So now night shift jobs, if you take, your insurance doesn't cover you much in the West if you're a night worker because they know you may get cancer. So now things are now working against us. So we should draw a line. How far can we play with nature? I'm not saying that technology should stop or we shouldn't use, but we must draw a line somewhere.
Dr. Menon, I read somewhere that consumption of pure cold-pressed coconut oil is helpful for preventing dementia and even reversing some amount of Alzheimer's. Is there any scientific basis for that?
Yeah, there is a lot of research, not on all of them, because each person's Alzheimer's is different. Why they came to that conclusion is because it has got a kind of fatty acid.
Medium chain fatty.
That the brain can use.
I see.
And brain, what they call is type 3 diabetes. You see, the brains in these people, they develop a diabetes called type 3, where the sugar cannot be used. So they call it a type 3 diabetes. Basically, the brains don't function on sugar. And invariably, they got high sugar levels, they got insulin resistance. And the shortcut to that was if the brain cell has to get energy, it uses this type of fatty acid.
May I ask a few personal questions? What kind of oil do you use, Dr. Menon, at home?
Well, after coming here, abroad it was easy for me, but after coming here, the oil, we use ghee as far as possible.
I see.
And the second thing is coconut oil is what we do. So olive oil is expensive, that's a problem. And people can't afford it. I would say that if you've got cold-pressed oil, even if it's mustard oil, and if you genetically, if you belong to West Bengal, they used mustard oil since ages. And mustard oil has got high levels of omega-3.
In Kashmir also, the traditional oil is mustard oil because that's what grows there.
Absolutely. So basically, you know, coconut oil they researched on because the American pediatrician who treated her husband who had Alzheimer's tried this oil. She did her own research on, you know, medium chain triglycerides and found it's useful for the brain. They found which oil has a lot of it. She found coconut oil has a lot of it. And she's the first one who introduced the subject, and then it went into research.
Yes.
And that's how it came up. So coconut oil came accidentally as being a good oil. It has been used in Kerala for centuries. But,
yes.
But unfortunately, if you refine it, that's the end of it. So
cold pressed.
It has to be cold pressed.
I see. And do you use a microwave?
I have one. Emergency, yes.
Okay.
But regularly, no. Mm-hmm. Not recommended.
I see.
Really.
And what are your sources of protein in your diet?
Well, that is one of the major issues that are coming up. And the only way we can compensate is introducing soya, provided all forms of soya are not good. And ladies shouldn't eat a lot of soya.
Yes. What is the threshold?
That is the problem. It differs from person to person. So you see, nutritional science has got a big handicap now that we can't measure. At least in India, we can't. Abroad, what they do is they feed you with a certain format of diet. Then they measure what are the levels of your cholesterol, what are the levels of your HDL, LDL, where is your sugar going, what are your hormones are doing. And they say, oh, okay, how are you feeling? And they say, this diet suits you. Certain people, they can't eat and switch to certain diets. Unfortunately here, you know, we don't have that science. Mm-hmm. We have to sort of go traditionally by asking, what do you generally eat traditionally in your house? Like Brahmins who are vegetarians, where did they get the protein from?
Mm.
Mainly it was dairy, and mainly it was from, you know, grains and pulses and seeds and nuts. So we had to go that route. Remember, protein is present in everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's present even in vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a wrong idea that protein is found only in meat and whatnot.
Yeah.
That is a wrong
concept.
And
tofu has protein.
Tofu is very good, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, the benefits of integrative medicine in today's age and day, especially in the West where big universities are investing money in it, is it to some extent measurable?
Oh, yes. What they've done is integrative medicine in the past belonged to a series of isolated doctors.
Right.
And most of them didn't have evidence-based, scientific analysis done.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this group of people are now getting referred to by the Western medicine and conventional doctors because they're failing in their treatment. And the success rates are now being reported, published. There's a series called Betrayal Series, and I would like all my listeners to go to this series called Betrayal Series.
Okay.
It's a set of videos, free online, and I don't know how long it'll be available, but if they go to that series, they will get the latest info.
Is it on YouTube or?
It's if you just go into betrayalseries.com,
okay.
They'll give you a link.
BETRAYAL.
Betrayal series. It's a betrayal because. And I would like to add here that the gut has been ignored by conventional medicine. And the gut has got bacteria living in it. And God has given us some extremely good bacteria that should be living there.
Mm-hmm.
This science is a very, very baby science now. Now the reports are coming in that if your gut is not happy, if the bacteria in there are not happy, and if the bad ones come there, it affects the whole system. So they call it the microbiome.
Mm-hmm.
And a large percentage of patients have got very unhealthy microbiome. This has been discovered. And if you correct the microbiome by a diet lifestyle and giving, you know, probiotics and other things, your symptoms disappear.
I see. Yogurt has natural probiotics.
Yes. Yogurt has got one type of the bacilli required.
What are the other sources of good probiotics?
Well, if you actually eat fermented foods, you know, in traditional...
Like miso and all?
In Indian tradition, pickles and fermented foods and fermentation of foods and pickling was a common thing.
Yeah.
You know, we used to pickle everything. And all these things have different forms of... gut bacteria.
I'm so happy to meet a doctor who endorses pickles. Thank you, Dr. Menon.
Yes.
We've been told to stay away from, you know, spicy food, hot food. Yes. Good
well,
to know.
The spiciness is another issue. Basically, I'm talking about pickling in a format that doesn't cause gastritis.
Hmm.
But today, you know, we find more of the spiciness and things have come in. But if you really look at fermented foods, they're fermented for a long time. Most of the pickles that you use, they have been fermenting in the oil juice of
yes.
the thing. And the chili bit nowadays has gone up quite a bit. So
in Japanese food, miso and kombucha.
Miso and kombucha.
Kombucha, both are
fermented. Yeah, so in every culture had.
Yeah.
Every culture had. If you look at every culture, they found it by trial and error. You see, most of the human beings have been living on this planet. And traditionally, grandmothers were handing out the recipes.
Mm.
They were sort of helping health. And traditionally, the tribals and the ancients knew that if we eat like this, everybody's happy and healthy. We are going the other way around. And today, you know, the manufacturing process. See, a manufactured jam is different from the jam my grandmother used to make. She had a peculiar way of making the jam. And while making it, a large percentage of bacteria and things used to get involved in it, which we thought was unhygienic. Today we realize that walking barefoot is a good thing to do. So our hygiene hypothesis has now failed. If you're too hygienic, then your immune system cannot recognize the good and bad. And we need the germs. God has made them. They are not in nature as our enemies. 80% to 90% of them are very healthy germs. It's only 10% that are naughty. And we need the 80 of them. But what we are doing is we are destroying all of them. And our way of looking at the human body is very odd. We feel that if you, you know, destroy the germs who are protecting us, you're very hygienic and clean. No.
You should see young mothers are constantly wiping the floors and their children's hands and actually rendering their children very poor in their immunity.
Swami himself said that walk barefoot.
Yeah.
And, you know, he says things which has got very deep meanings.
And he himself walked barefooted.
Exactly. And he says that how will you get the immunity? You know? So even cesarean sections are causing problems. They would prefer that the baby is born normally. Because while the baby is born, the baby gets all the bacteria, the flora, which is going to actually go into the gut and produce the first set of the bacteria in the gut. And breastfeeding also does that. And invariably, cesarean sections, they found, is causing babies to become extremely allergic and prone to ill health. So the trick they're doing now is they wipe the baby's face with a swab that is taking the mother's secretions. So science is going round and round saying if nature knows best, you leave everything as natural as possible. You don't have to really, you know, jump over the wall. If you really lead a life where nature intended and or know how to switch off and know how to, you know, allow nature to do this kind of healing once in a while, you know, you can do a cyclic system of I'll fast on, you know, 2 days a week or 1 day a week. On certain days I will eat only these kind of foods. So if you give body a chance to recover and you are mentally happy and, you know, you're very positive, you don't need to, you know, see a doctor at all. And you must get the love and support too. So it's not just, you know, quick fix. Our whole social fundamental attitude of why we are here on earth and what we doing here, what is the purpose of our life, comes into the picture. Unfortunately, you know, we are all target oriented and we all got deadlines. And we feel that a person reaches 20, a deadline should be hit. A person reaches 30, another deadline should be hit. We are living very artificial lives. Does it affect health? Well, it's obvious it is. $4.3 trillion is the budget of the economy in the United States, projected for 2023. $4.3 trillion is quite a huge amount without the success being there. So building more super hospitals and more having more cardiac surgeons doing more interventional cardiac surgery is not the answer, because how many can afford that? What about the rest of the population? They will be ignored. So we need a preventive approach, not for the rich, not for the poor, for humanity itself, to realize that, you know, let's work with nature instead of isolating ourselves from it.
Well, Dr. Menon, this has been quite an eye-opening session just listening to you and learning from you. But I still have a whole lot of questions to ask of you, including all these things that we hear about cleansing, emotional cleansing, spiritual detox, physical detox. I want to know about how much exercise and what sort of exercise we need on a regular basis. We hear all kinds of different formulae, 30 minutes, 5 times a week minimum. And does it have to be something related to aerobics or weights? How important is all that? And there are many other topics that we need enlightenment on. But I guess for today we'll pause right here. I just want to take this opportunity to thank you very, very much for sharing your insights and your wisdom with us.
Thank you, Sairam. It was a pleasure.
Sairam, sir. Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome back to Morning Glory on Thursday Live on this very auspicious Avatar Declaration Day, October the 20th, 2016. The time in Prashanthi Nilayam right now is exactly 58 minutes past 10 a.m., that is Indian Standard Time, and we are coming to you live on our Asia stream. You just heard a special conversation with Dr. Sunil Menon, the head of the Department of General Medicine at the Sri Sathya Sai General Hospital here in Prashanthi Nilayam. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. We look forward to your feedback, comments and thoughts regarding this interview, of which the next part should be played right here with Swami's Grace on Morning Glory next Thursday. Now, you have an opportunity to ask a question of Dr. Menon if you have one. I've already received a couple and I've already forwarded them to Dr. Menon. Should you have, but the first question was about protein, and shortly after I received that question, I realized that Dr. Menon already answered that question quite extensively. Should you have any further queries or doubts, please feel free to send me your questions at the earliest. Earliest means by end of today, because tomorrow we are recording with Dr. Menon again. And my email ID is karuna@radiosai.org. Now, I will try to incorporate your questions in my interview for tomorrow, and I'll bring you that interview next week right here on Morning Glory. That would be the 27th of October. And dear listeners, as always, we look forward to your feedback to this interview and the live studio interview with Dr. Kiran Bala Arora, and any other Radio Sai programs. Your comments, thoughts, feedback are valuable to us. You can always reach us at this email ID, listener@radiosai.org. Now, apart from next week's special conversation with Dr. Menon, we will begin the 91st year of Divine Advent celebrations from November, which is coming up soon. So throughout the month of November on Morning Glory, with Swami's blessings, we have an extraordinary series of readings titled Self-Reflection. I'm going to tell you a little bit, but not too much about it today. These are readings of articles of great gravitas and insight that give us a peek into Sai history, Sai glory, and details never known before. A senior devotee who is sharing these with us wrote these pieces over the past 25 or 30 years for some special commemorative editions. But very few people had access to these limited edition volumes. So recently we were honored to have this senior devotee who has started to read out and record his own articles that trace amazing behind-the-scene details of Sai history from the lens of the person who was serving the Lord every single day, spending time with him daily. Yes, you heard it right. And you know what? He got 3 to 4 Padmanabhaskars a day. That one just blows me off. Because he was the chosen instrument of the Lord. Anyways, I urge you to please not miss that special 91st birthday offering right here on Morning Glory throughout the month of November. And I will tell you more about this series of self-reflection next week on Morning Glory. With that, I'm perfectly on time. It is now time for me to bid you Sairam and offer Morning Glory at the lotus feet of our Lord. This is a very grateful Karuna from Team Radio Sai signing off and thanking you for your company. Till we meet next Thursday, please be well, keep seeking and stay inspired. And right after signing off, I'm going to run off to the Satsang building where the women alumni of Swami School and Colleges are meeting for a very informal and intimate session with all the sisters where we will bond with each other and with our elders. And those of our sisters who are listening and are not able to join, we carry your love in our hearts and we will pray to Swami to bless you wherever you are. We don't even have to pray. Swami is always with you, dear sisters and dear listeners. With that, I'd like to say Jai Sai Ram, and here is a very important announcement from Professor G. Venkatraman. He likes to call it an advance alert. So, please don't miss it. Take care and Jai Sai Ram.
Sai Ram, dear listeners, we have an important announcement for you, and here to make it is Professor G. Venkatraman. Over to the professor.
Loving Sai Ram and greetings from Prashanti Nilayam. Right from the time I came to Swami a quarter of a century ago, I have always been eager to understand the deeper implications of Swami's core teachings. This activity has been continuous and involved much self-learning rooted first in the Bhagavad Gita and then in Swami's innumerable discourses. Not many may be aware that while the Bhagavad Gita is presented in 700 tightly packed slokas or hymns, Swami has parsed, amplified and expanded them into well over 1,000 or more discourses, going back at least to the 50s when recording devices first became available. Radio Sai itself has in its collection several hundreds of such discourses, and some listeners might be familiar with them via Radio Sai's exclusive discourse channel. Times have changed, and presently life has become so busy for almost everyone that even ardent devotees find little time to reflect on Swami's teachings. As if this is not enough, the literate on the one hand and young people on the other, each group for its own reason, seems to be of the opinion that basic moral values are no longer relevant in a globalized world. Indeed, this appears to be true almost all over the world. In countries of the East, a very large percentage of the population still declare that they believe in religion. Nevertheless, when it comes to actually putting the teachings of their religion into practice, there seems to be little appetite for it. I would go so far as to say that even if there is a trace of appetite, people have no time for feeding even that feeble spiritual hunger. I have been keenly following this drift away from practical spirituality from the time when the disinterest in basic values was a small trickle to the present day when it has assumed almost tsunami-like proportions. I do not wish to sound preachy, but I do feel that there is a definite need to pause and reflect, at least occasionally, on the basic question as to whether it is at all possible to have a global society totally bereft of core non-negotiable moral values. Think about it. You see, the point I am making is particularly important because lately, more and more people the world over, especially the young, are veering to the view that absolute moral values are totally irrelevant in a globalized world. Indeed, the cry is louder for rights and entitlements rather than the duties and the obligations that every one of us owes to our conscience as well as human society as a whole. Keeping this in mind, I have, after consulting a few here in Radio Sai, decided to offer a series of talks every alternate week. Every talk would be short, have a particular theme, and also relevant to the situation prevailing in today's world. That being said, all talks would revolve around what Swami patiently taught decade after decade, indeed going back to an era when the audiences were small and there were no recording devices. This announcement is by way of alerting all of you out there. I do honestly hope you would spare the time to listen in directly or at least the podcast. I would also request you to spread the word around so that those who are not aware can also listen. That's all for now. Thank you for listening. God bless and Jai Sai Ram.
This is Radio Sai Studio back again. As you just heard, Professor Venkatraman would be starting a new series of talks on the broad theme, the relevance of basic moral values in the globalized age. As he mentioned, this talk would be broadcast every alternate week. Because of the importance of the topic, it has been decided to include these talks as part of our regular and highly popular Thursday Live programs, but only every alternate week. Please note, on Thursday Live, but only every alternate week. We gather that Professor would give his first talk on Thursday, the 27th of October. Please spread the word to the extent you can by all means available to you. Thank you for listening, and Jai Sai Ram.